Today, we have with us a seasoned family law practitioner, Ms. Susan Chay, who is also my supervising solicitor and dearest mentor. Susan has been a family lawyer for over 30 years, despite not looking a day over 30 herself. Susan, let's start with a little self-introduction. Please share with our listeners why you got into law, family law in particular, and how have your years of practice been?
Before I start, I just want to say this, Chloe. 30 years? That's a bit of a stretch. But that is so sweet, and I was so touched when you called me your sweet mentor. Okay, about me. I've been in practice since 1988. 2 years later, I started my own law firm with a partner. Although I didn't focus on family law early in those years, I definitely remember my first family case. You know, of all my early cases, I really remember that first family case. I guess from that moment onward, I probably would have guessed that family law will have that special place in my heart, have that special meaning for my practice. After many years of acquiring wisdom and experience, I decided, okay, this is what I want to do. This is what I want to focus on, and it is going to be family.
Thank you, Susan. You talk about your first family law case so fondly. So I have this question. What was your initial vision of how family law ought to be practiced? And has this vision changed over the years?
To be honest, Chloe, I mean, remember when I started my firm, I was like 2 years after practice, I was 26 years old. So I'll be lying if I tell you I had a vision. Back in those days, and even now, I guess, clients come to you, they have issues at home, they want to know their rights. You felt like, okay, I'm your protector, I'm going to be battling for your rights. So you charge into court like a warrior, thinking that you engage in there fighting for your client's rights. Today, I don't want to practice as a family lawyer like a warrior anymore, especially in cases where there are children involved. How do I want to do it? I want to advocate the peace approach. I want to help the clients navigate their way towards other pathways to resolutions. Hopefully, we can work towards mending the relationships, but at least maintaining a co-parenting relationship especially, and try not to sever that bond.
So from being a warrior to being a peace advocate, Susan, why are you the first port of call for someone contemplating or going through a divorce?
Guess I am still known as a family lawyer. If you have an issue at home and you are contemplating divorce, you want to go and see a divorce lawyer, right? So I guess that's why I have clients coming to me first to say, hey, I am very troubled at home. Maybe I just found out my husband has an affair. I want to know what my rights are if I want to divorce him. I want to know whether I have rights over my children, whether care and control can be given to me. I want to know whether I will have a roof over my head. I want to know if, okay, I'm going to leave him. Can I still pay my expenses? Will he help me pay those expenses? Things like that. So these are very, very fundamental questions they want answered. Right? So many of the clients came to me to say, perhaps I'm not ready for divorce, but I really do want to know. If I do get a divorce, what are my rights?
So as you often say, divorce truly is one of the top three most traumatic events in a person's life. So apart from this whole litany of legal issues, how do you tend to the more emotional and sometimes psychological aspects?
When I was practicing as a family, I mean, in family cases, when I was very young, I will have to be honest and tell you that I don't deal with emotions very well. And sometimes you can hear lawyers telling each other, oh, those are the emotional stuff. They are messy. We don't deal with them. Come to me if you want to know your legal rights. Okay. But the truth is, emotions are a huge part of family matters, you know. They don't come like isolated. Oh, I just want to know my rights. No, they always come with a bag full of negative emotions, actually. They are confused, they are angry, they are sad, and they are lost because they don't know what to do. They haven't decided how to move. So you do have to, with experience, right? And Chloe, this is for you as a young lawyer. Don't rush it. But with experience, you will be able to tell, maybe this client is not ready. Sometimes they are really still grieving. Why is it that I say they are not ready? When they are not in the right state of mind, they will not make the right decisions. And as you navigate with them through the divorce process, understand that you can't make many of these decisions for your client. You can only guide them. You're like the light or the lighthouse, right? But you cannot tell them, okay, this is exactly how you should do it, what you should do. So pick them when you think they are of the right frame of mind to make these decisions, because decisions during divorce proceedings are very, very important. They have significant outcomes, right? And impact, not just on the client, but on the family members as well, like children, even parents, right? In-laws, helpers, yeah. Things like that.
Thank you, Susan. So the family court often emphasizes that the paramount consideration for children issues in a divorce is the best interest of the child. So my understanding is that lawyers often interact solely with one of the parents. How do you listen and understand the child's voice? And when there is tension between what the parent wants versus what's in the best interest of the child, how do you advise your clients?
Good question. On top of that, Chloe, I must tell you, I don't have children myself. So like people ask me, how in the world will you understand children? You don't even have them. I always say, excuse me, I was a child before, so I know, right? Although I have to say, I may not know the state of mind of every child. I do have to actively put myself in the shoes of the children. So I often tell my client, when you are here and I'm listening to your children's issue, I'm sorry, you know, the person I really want to protect is the child first. Because that's exactly where the court is going, right? You tell me, no, she's not a good parent. She's not caring for the child properly. The court wants to know, not just whether she really is a good parent or not, but then how do you take care of the child? If you say she's not a good parent, then how are you going to care for the child? You know, that's exactly what best interest of the child means, okay? You don't just mudsling and say, okay, this is not good enough, that's not good enough. Then what is good enough? How are you providing that good enough for the child? A lot of parents think that they know what's best for their own child. But I'm afraid I have to be blunt about this. During divorce, often they don't. They're very clouded by their own emotions because they're angry with the other half as a spouse. A lousy spouse makes a lousy parent, you know? Or they can only remember all the bad things, right? Oh, he doesn't know how to feed the child, you know? He only knows how to play with them. So, you know, because your memory of what the other spouse was like as a parent is already clouded by your own emotions. So very often we will have to ask the right questions, right? Very objective questions. Sometimes it's just about, how is the child faring in school? You know, how is the access like? How are their interactions with the parent? And very often the answers will tell you whether the child is in a good place or not with the other parent. And from there, you will know, okay, maybe it's not about him being a parent. Maybe the child is actually quite okay. And I want to say this also, my personal feeling is this. During marriage, if this is a functional family, when you were happily married, then the child should be happy with both, right? If the divorce is caused because parties are not happy with each other, not so much because parties are not good to the kids, then really, what's wrong with co-parenting? What's wrong with sharing parenting? My personal belief is that in a family like that, actually, I'm going for equal sharing of the caring of the kids, because this is good for the child. This will give the security to the child that both parents still love the child. Yeah. And, you know, it's what's best for him or her.
I think it's important that some parents need to hear this, especially when they feel like they should be the only ones in their child's life, especially when they're in such an antagonistic state with the other party.
What they are dealing with a lot of times is, I cannot co-parent with him or her. We just don't agree. But what they forgot is that their disagreement is with each other. And that disagreement itself is bad for the kids. So how you want to work towards better co-parenting relationship, many times you need help. You need counseling, maybe. You know, you need to be guided to teach you how to communicate, say, after something antagonistic like the divorce, you know. So go there and seek help for the sake of the kids. That's how I feel, really, you know. Not be continually engaged in the antagonism and then forgetting that in the meantime, there's a child suffering. Yeah. So you want to know what's best for the kids? Stop fighting and start sharing your responsibilities.
As a collaborative family lawyer, could you explain to our listeners how collaborative divorce works in practice? And what would be your most memorable collaborative case?
Collaborative family practice, right, is when two parties are very determined to go through the divorce process without the acrimony in litigation. So before you even file your papers, you both go and see a collaborative family lawyer. Why is it important that both sides also must have the collaborative family practice? It's because then our views are aligned. What is that view? That view is, okay, we must talk until we settle, right? We don't talk with a view that, okay, if this does not work, we go and fight in court. A collaborative family lawyer is not supposed to also represent the client in the litigation. So if the negotiation failed, then they have to appoint somebody else. Okay, so that's the collaborative family practice. And in a collaborative family session, let's say, not only are lawyers present, sometimes you can have a financial counselor who's also similarly trained, and a mental health counselor who's also similarly trained, right? So sometimes, you know, as we all know, family disputes can be multifaceted, right? And it's very emotional. A lot of times it deals with money. So these are all the right experts to come in to advise, okay? You might think, oh, $500 is enough as maintenance for the kids. The financial counselor will then tell you, no, it's not quite enough. Or the other person will say, hey, he can jolly well afford to give $3,000. But actually, maybe his salary is only $3,500. You know, and somebody else will tell them, okay, you know, from my objective view, this is not workable. Because at the point of time when both parties are already quite angry with each other, right? They will not trust each other. They will not trust that you can't pay $3,000. You have money hidden somewhere. Yeah, so all these experts coming together to help you see that objectively, this is the situation. We will sort out all the issues cleverly because there is a structured way you guide the conversation so that it doesn't get too angry, so that parties can come up with their own solutions.
So Susan, you mentioned this gathering of experts. So for our listeners, Susan's firm, OTP Law Corporation, is also part of Practice Forte Advisory, which she co-founded. How has being a part of this advisory enhanced your practice of family law? And who are some of the affiliates you often work with, collaborate with, and why?
It has done many, many good things for the firm. When I first started the firm, it was only until 5 years ago that we began to think big. It was always just two partners, three lawyers, you know. So it was a small firm. And there were many things we wanted to do that we couldn't do, right? We thought perhaps handling a dispute shouldn't be just about fighting in court, right? We thought it should be more multidisciplinary. We thought that really, there are some other ways, there are other pathways to resolution of a dispute. But, you know, with a small law firms of three lawyers, you just don't have, firstly, you don't have the capacity. Secondly, you don't have the mind space as well. In 2015, when we started Practice Forte Advisory, Mylene, my co-founder, and I, we really sat down and thought about how we want to see the bending of all these small firms that didn't have the capacity, didn't have the mind space. How can we come together to say, let's make our practice more? Yet, we are still nimble as a small firm. Yeah, so we visualize it. we try to make it happen. When we first started, it was three law firms, and we started to try and work with each other because there was a corporate firm, there was a civil litigation firm, and then there was a family firm. So we share work, you know, oh, I don't do family, you do. And then we work together to service the client. And the client felt, hey, although you guys are individually small, I felt like, okay, you know, this is still a one-stop shop. But we go beyond just law firms after this, because we thought, huh, there's got to be a way to see whether we can resolve disputes peacefully. Maybe we bring in other professionals so that the solution's more complete. And then we brought in people who are doing counseling, therapists, the mental health experts. Eventually, we also have a panel of mediators. And then before I know it, hey, we are going overseas. And we got special training to be even more focused. For example, my family practice, I am now also a mediator, so I'm mediation trained. And on top of that, it's very specialized. I'm trained in handling hate cases of parental child abduction. So this is all happening because we now have this grouping where we tap on each other's expertise and then we share our work that becomes more and more layered, more and more complex. And then we do even cross-border things. Very, very soon, we will be training. And we don't only just train in Singapore, we will be training in ASEAN countries, and we are trying to build a connect between EU and ASEAN. I mean, these are not things a small law firm of three lawyers will be able to do. But this is now possible because we have the advisory that is 15 firms, almost 50 professionals. So we're very proud.
I'm very happy to be a part of this.
Yes,
thank
Chloe.
Thank you for the opportunity.
When you say your law firm, you mean our law firm.
So thank you for bringing up mediation. For our listeners, Susan is an accredited mediator with a sizable number of accolades under her belt. Almost all her cases have resulted in a settlement, culminating in enforceable consent orders before the courts. So Susan, in high-stress situations where parties are confrontational, positional, with a lot of emotional baggage, how do you, as the mediator, navigate this divide?
How can I explain in a short sentence a very complex, structured way of guiding the two parties into a negotiation? Effectively, mediation is just a way to negotiate between the parties. I'm not here to say that I'm a skilled mediator, but having trained a lot, I do a lot of training. A good mediator should have the skill. First, you need to understand, go beyond the positions to understand underlying that position. What is it? What is it that is so important to them? This is a story that was told during all sorts of mediation training about if you give a person an orange, right? And that person says, I want the whole orange. And both of them want that same orange. Then how do you split that, right? Yes. And then the trainer will tell you, if you find out really that one party just wants the juice and the other party really just wants the skin, then that's how you split. So that's the skill of a good mediator. You go beyond the position and you find out, actually, what is it that you really want? And maybe it's what he's prepared to give. Okay? And you've got to get to that space. That's in a gist, but of course, it's a lot more complicated than that.
Susan, as a witness and active participant to 3 decades of changes in family law in Singapore, what is your opinion of therapeutic justice that the family courts have introduced? And moving forward, what does this mean for parties and for family lawyers?
I am very, very excited. When we started PF Restructure, okay, and I was trying to explain, right, getting the grouping of the experts, coming up with a structured way, a peace approach to resolving dispute, that was before therapeutic justice was so heavily advocated by the family courts in Singapore. And so when I've heard that, oh, wow, they are very keen to introduce family into family court, the therapeutic justice, how therapeutic justice is to be administered, I was very, very excited. Because it's so aligned with the vision, right, that we have been promoting, okay? It's so aligned with the vision that we are promoting. I want to just say this. Therapeutic justice is still a fairly new concept here in Singapore. If you ask me, I don't really know how exactly step by step is going to be done in the family court. I can't advise my client, this is what's going to happen. These are the changes. So now you don't have to do this, you have to do that. But what is very clear over the years that's been happening is that is the introduction of things like counseling and mediation. As I don't know whether the listeners know this, but if you go through a divorce, you have a child or children under the age of 21 years old, you need to go for, firstly, even before you file your divorce papers, you need to go for a mandatory parenting program counseling. Secondly, post filing of your papers, you need to go through mediation, okay, and further counseling. So this is the court's way of telling everybody, try to take a peace approach towards resolving your dispute. Why? Because litigation can only make your relationship worse. And a bad relationship, you cannot function. You cannot even communicate how you're going to be co-parenting. Such an important role like co-parents. How are you going to do that? So they introduce this and they introduce mediation. What may change though is perhaps how hearings are going to be conducted. Maybe, you know. They are trying to simplify processes so that it is easier, it's not so intimidating, right? They have recently come out with a panel of accounting experts, right? Maybe this panel, this is a trial one, maybe this panel will be there to say to parties, okay, from my experience, this is what I think will happen, this is the size of the pool, blah, 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 you know, so that you don't have to go to court, fight it out to find out all these things. So they are trying to simplify the process or to bring in other professionals, make it more multidisciplinary, bring in the social sciences, the mental health experts, because it really can affect a person. Divorce, depression, anxiety, you know, so such that you can't function, you can't work. But what's worse, you affect the child or affect your children, right? So I see that happening, and it will happen quite quickly, I suspect, this year and next.
So with this shift in focus away from litigation towards mediation and counselling, do you think that legal practitioners in Singapore are doing enough to encourage mediation?
Maybe I want to answer another, if I may.
Mm-mm, sure.
Okay, with therapeutic justice, right, what's going to happen to the legal profession? If people say, oh, I will stop going to court, right? I will want to try and resolve this nicely. Let's just use counselors, don't use lawyers, because lawyers always fight, right? Maybe we talk about that. That might have a little bit of bearing on mediation. Yes. So if people stop going to court, maybe lawyers are not going to be the foremost in their head. But I don't think so. That's probably the popular belief. Oh yeah, lawyers are going to lose their job. No. Because you will still want to know whether this is aligned with the rights. This is aligned with how the court view is fair. This is aligned with how the court view is in the best interest of the child. And that person to tell you is a lawyer. So you still want a lawyer. When you are negotiating, when you're coming to a settlement, you want to know, hey, whatever we are agreeing to is valid in law. By the way, for example, I want to tell you, if I have two kids, and I want to split the kids. You take one, I take one. I want to tell you now, judges very often frown upon this kind of arrangements. Why? Because it's not in the best interest of the kids to split them as siblings. Okay? So you might not know that, right? So you want a lawyer to be helping you to understand all these things and to even help you draft the settlement agreement. No matter how much you think, okay, you want to avoid acrimony. One of the important elements of a good settlement is that it is an enduring settlement. What's an enduring settlement? An enduring settlement is one where it will just carry on for a long time and something that you want to stand by because it works, right? And for that to happen, you really want to have someone to have an eye on it and say, yes, this will work even for the next 5 years. Okay. So even in the drafting of the settlement agreement, you want a lawyer. Let's talk about whether lawyers encourage mediation enough or not. I have a theory, which is going to come out in my article. A lot of people think, not enough take-up rate for mediation. It's the lawyer's fault because they don't want to encourage their client to take up mediation in case it affects their fat fee. I don't agree. I don't know if people are familiar with this first impulse reaction of a person when they are in a very traumatic situation. Have you heard of this flight, flee, freeze? Flight, flee, freeze is not, let's sit down together and talk this through. It's just not. When you are in that situation, your reaction is, I don't want to sit down with that person I'm having a dispute with to talk things through. So the idea of mediation is not something that they welcome immediately. And in fact, I can tell you now, a lot of my clients, the idea of, oh my God, I have to be in the same room. I have to be facing this person and talking to him. And what? To deal with all these issues that I cannot resolve for the past 10 years, suddenly in this one session I can? I don't think so, right? They have this mentality. So many of them are, they don't see mediation as a good resolution pathway. They think it's better the court tell us what to do. There's an order of court, he has to obey. What they don't know is that often the judge doesn't give the orders that both parties... Firstly, it's not going to be an order both parties will like. And quite often, it's an order that both parties don't like. Right? Yeah. So, we need to educate. And my other view is that nobody likes to walk into a mediation by themselves. So they still need someone. They need a representative. And this is where a mediation advocate comes in. What's my dream job? My dream job is a mediation advocate. It's everything I want and everything I believe in resolving disputes. I'm here. I protect her interests or my client's interests. I go in. I present the case. I persuade. And when there is a settlement, I make sure there is an enduring settlement. And this all has to be explained to the client such that she's comfortable walking into the mediation session and knowing that, okay, this can be resolved and maybe this can be resolved well. Any kind of solution that's effective, nobody can persuade you not to use it. Not even a lawyer. So hopefully one day, with all of us making the conscious effort to promote good mediation, effective mediation, maybe the take-up rate will go up.
Susan, so you mentioned that nowadays you do a lot of international and cross-border work as well. So my understanding is that family law firms traditionally don't cross-border the way that commercial firms do. So how does this work in family context for you, for OTP, for Practice Forte?
Okay, first, maybe let me start with statistics. So this is a statistics that you can find in the Singapore statistics. One in three marriages involve one party. It's not a citizen of Singapore. This I heard from someone in the embassy. Four out of seven children in Singapore have one parent who's not a Singapore citizen. So a family coming from at least binational or even trinational kind of background is very real. My family, for example, okay, both my sisters married non-Singaporeans. One married to an Australian, one married to a Malaysian, right? So it's happening everywhere. A family dispute with this kind of demographics will necessarily involve the international element because many times these people, they are not here as citizens. They don't migrate here. They come here to work or they come here on long-term visit pass or maybe even permanent residence. When a marriage breaks down, very, very often, the spouse who come to Singapore, say as a stay-home mom or stay-home dad, right, will find no more reason to stay here. Because most of the time, their family members are back home. Okay? And so their instinct is, okay, I want to move. And that is why we have quite a fair bit of parental abduction cases. Because in Singapore, once you move here, can you just leave the country without the other party's consent, without the other parent's consent? The answer is no. If he or she says no, you have to go to court to apply for the court to sanction you leaving the country. So the international element in our practice will involve quite often laws relating to those countries. And when there is a Hague case in Singapore, right, you want to be dealing not just with the lawyers in this country, you will also want to be dealing with lawyers in the country where the child is now, right? So there's a lot of all this kind of cross-border work. Now, you as a lawyer, you can't practice, right? I mean, you and I know we can't just take our suitcase and go and practice in Malaysia, Thailand and all that. But do you know as a mediator you can? As a mediation advocate, there is no bar to a foreign mediation advocate bring a case here in Singapore. Okay, if they are a mediation advocate, they can practice here. The Legal Profession Act does not bar them from practicing here. So, the good thing is, if you use the peace approach, right, you can actually engage somebody from home, an expert or professional from home who will understand your situation, will speak the same language, that's a very important as well, yeah, to help you navigate your way. And very often, this is quicker, easier, and of course, you know, as compared to litigation, the fees are also, it comes to the nub of the problem quicker. If you litigate this matter, I mean, it will take years, and it will take many countries. Very often, a hate case involves at least two countries, sometimes three, quite often. So, you know, imagine how long that's going to take. I just did one mediation that's online during COVID with parties from two other different countries. So there are three different countries involved. We log in every day, every week at the same time, right? And then we talk about this. And so much easier and quicker.
Thank you for that illuminating discussion on the Hague Convention, Susan. So bringing it a little closer to home, I've noticed this trend in young peers these days. Couples who are in a committed relationship tend to apply for BTO, and because they know that it takes years to get the flat. And in the meantime, they register their marriage, but when the flat finally comes around in 4 to 5 years' time, they realize they don't want to be together anymore. So in a situation like this, what would your advice be?
Chloe, so interesting to know that young people these days are just like young people of my time. Really? I mean, like, back in my days, right, we were already talking about how, okay, let's get out of this. I want to get out of my own home quickly. Let's get another flat. And then we move out and then we get married. And then, oh dear, you're really not you're really not who I want to end up with. So this is very common. It's been happening since a long time ago, maybe since HDB has started. Okay. Nobody should get married to each other for reasons other than the fact that they think they can grow old together and they can share a life together. And they can be happy together, right? Definitely not over a flat. But if they decide, okay, this is the end, what should they do about their flat? The best way really is to find somebody who can help them guide through what to do with that flat. I mean, this is... A flat or a matrimonial home is usually the biggest asset in any married couple's life. Because it's so big, it's actually a very serious issue, right? I mean, practically your whole savings, especially for a young person. So you want to deal with it maturely, you want to deal with it carefully. And definitely this is an area you want professional help in. And if you are able to sit down, discuss, like I've already explained all the good things about mediation, okay, it's something you can resolve without spending a lot of money in court fighting over a case, without the many years that you engage in, and then without all the heartache, right? But sometimes you are unable to talk to each other anymore. So get the professionals to help you do this. It will not be a lot. It will not be a lot of your resources, a lot of time and all that. You can resolve this properly, carefully, and quickly.
So speaking of saving resources, when clients come to you and say that they want to do the peace approach, a collaborative divorce, and they want to do it uncontested and simplified, could they just use the one lawyer to represent both parties? Will that save them money? Is there a package deal of sorts?
I always advise against that. Always. Actually, in a divorce proceedings, even if it's completely amenable, right, you can't represent two parties. Why? Because inherent in the fact that it's two parties is already that conflict of interest, right? If I protect the wife, I might not be protecting the husband, vice versa. So I always say, get that two professionals in so that you know fully what your rights are, right? You are going in eyes wide open. You're not always doubting, hey, the other, this lawyer are really protecting me or not? Or maybe protecting her more or protecting him more, right? You will not have that doubt. Your lawyer is your lawyer. He will tell you, he or she will tell you, okay, this is what you have to do. But if you are going to settle this nicely, peacefully, maybe you're prepared to give up this. Maybe she will be prepared to give up that, right? So you go in, eyes wide open. Another important ingredient for an enduring agreement. Because you don't want the next day to go, huh? Wait, how come I didn't know this? Then the lawyer tell me, I should just do that. But I didn't know about that, right? So this is why I always say, no, get your own lawyer.
Unfortunately, our time is almost up. To end off, Susan, could you share with our listeners what you think is the most important piece of advice that those going through a divorce need to hear?
This is not something new, and I've said it before. There is always light at the end of the tunnel.
Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to check out our other episodes as we interview more of our professionals and understand why they could be your first port of call. For any inquiries, do contact our client care specialist, Sandra, at 6221-3009.